turned out to be something of a fraud. And as a matter of fact, the book I'm about to refer to was published when he was in prison for fraud. But the book was titled Chariots of the Gods? And his proposal in this book was that aliens, space aliens, had visited the Earth any number of times, but particularly in ancient times, and that many of the wonders of the ancient world were, according to von Daniken's proposal, built using alien technology. In addition, he proposed that any number of ancient drawings and historical accounts were, in fact, drawings and accounts of meetings with these space aliens. In particular, he assured his reader that the first chapter of Ezekiel was one of these accounts, an account of Ezekiel's meeting with an alien spaceship, which he then, in his own way and in his own context, interpreted as a visit from God. Now, it's easy perhaps for us to look back those 45 years into the past and perhaps scoff at von Daniken, but von Daniken made a fair amount of money off of that book, enough to pay off his debts and get him out of jail. And he ran on to publish several more along the same lines. And I suspect that there are many people who read that book who have a very difficult time reading the opening chapter of Ezekiel and several of the other passages in Ezekiel. I have a difficult time reading them and seeing anything other than an alien spaceship descending on the Babylonian plain. And once you've got that image in your head, it's probably a little difficult to get rid of. Well, over this weekend's messages, I'd like to see if we can draw back a bit from that and dispel some of those images and get a different take, get a different image of not only Ezekiel's vision, but of Ezekiel himself and of his message. I'd like to begin that journey by spending our time looking at chapter 1 of Ezekiel tonight, which I have titled The Divine Glory in Exile. I'll get to that a little bit later in the message, but I want to look at four particular questions, I suppose, tonight. First of all, who had the vision? Who is this character that we meet as Ezekiel? Second, what was it that he saw? Was it an alien spaceship? Or was it something much more terrifying? Thirdly, and this might seem like a silly question, but where did he see it? Where he saw it has profound implications for the message of the book as a whole, and its message for us as well. And that's really the fourth question, so what? What does it mean for us? Is this just an ancient historical record of something of historical curiosity, but with little significance beyond that? Some of you children haven't figured out what you want to do with your lives yet. And you figure, I'm still in junior high or I'm still in high school, and that's okay. I don't need to know yet. Others of you may already have an idea of what you want to do. I remember my older sister, by the time she was 8, knew that she wanted to be a nurse. And for one semester in college, she sort of toyed with the idea of being a doctor instead. That meant she had to take physics. Physics wasn't her strong suit. And she decided that she was quite happy with being a nurse. Some of you are doing jobs perhaps that you never imagined that you would be doing. But I want us now to take a trip, to take a journey of the imagination. I want us to go back approximately 2,600 years into the past. And I want us to travel about 6 time zones east to the region that we know now as Iraq, but 2,600 years ago was part of the, in fact, the center of the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar was on the throne. Nebuchadnezzar, as is the wont of most emperors, was seeking to expand his empire. And that meant he had to move west. And in moving west, he came upon the small nation of Judah. And Judah was being somewhat recalcitrant about being enfolded into the wonderful arms of the Babylonian Empire. So he took the man who had just been made king of Judah, he'd been on the throne all of 3 months, took him off the throne and put someone else on the throne, a man by the name that he gave the name Zedekiah. Well, Zedekiah was apparently someone who fancied himself a politician. He figured that he could find a political solution that would pit Egypt against Babylon and would deliver Judah from Babylonian oppression. Didn't work. Zedekiah wasn't quite the politician he thought he was. And as a result, Nebuchadnezzar came back in with his army and they said, okay, you cooperate, and in order to ensure your cooperation, we're going to take a significant number of your people hostage. We generally think of it in terms of exile, but in those days, that's practically what these people were. They were hostages. They were to guarantee, as it were, the cooperation of the man who was in charge of Judah. One of those people was a man by the name of Ezekiel. Now, you have to think, remember, 2,600 years ago, you grow up in Judah. What do? What's your career, as it were? You do what your father did. If your father was a farmer, you farmed. If your father was a potter, you became a potter. If your father worked with leather, you became a leather worker. Now, Ezekiel's father was a priest. He came from a priestly family. And you can imagine Ezekiel grows up in that priestly family. And he hears that conversation, you know, sort of that technical conversation. I used to live in Durham. And I had some friends who were medical students or residents at the medical center there at Duke. And whenever I was over at their house for dinner, the conversation was generally medical technicalities, the kind of thing that most of us don't generally talk about over the dinner table. But you can imagine conversations around Ezekiel's dinner table. That's what he grew up with, and that's what he grew up expecting to be. In ancient Israel, the priests would grow up in a priestly family, and at the age of 25, they would begin their training, their apprenticeship And they would have a 5-year apprenticeship, and at the end of that 5-year apprenticeship, they would become full-fledged priests, and they would minister according to their schedule in the temple of the Lord. That's the set of expectations that Ezekiel grew up with. Now, you may have noticed in the very first verse, the first line of the chapter, it says, in the 30th year, in the 4th month, on the 5th day of the month. We're told in the second verse that this 30th year, whatever it was also the 5th year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. So that puts us in about the year 592 B.C. But the 30th year, what does that refer to? It's nowhere else mentioned in the book. And as you can imagine, scholars have a lot of ideas. One of the popular ideas is, well, this is the 30th year since the finding of the book of the law in the temple under the reign of Josiah. 1 Kings 22 gives us the account of that. Well, the timing is right. The book of the law was found in 622 B.C., so this would certainly be 30 years later. But there's certainly not anything in the book of Ezekiel that would lead us to make that connection. Some have suggested that, well, it was the 30th year since the last Jubilee. Now, again, there's nothing in the book of Ezekiel that would lead us to expect that. And the third view that is fairly common and which I hold, although I don't think it's necessary for my exposition, but it does works out nicely, is that the 30th year is Ezekiel's 30th year. All right. Think of it. You're Ezekiel. You've grown up in Jerusalem. You've spent your life imagining what it would be like to be a priest. And you're looking forward to serving in that role. You're a man of faith, and you recognize the importance of the priestly task. And so, as your 25th birthday gets closer and closer, as the years pass, your excitement increases. And then something happens. The political situation changes. And suddenly you and a bunch of other characters are hauled off to Babylon. You're 25 years old. You were about to begin your apprenticeship as a priest. You were about to begin to do what you have been aiming at for your entire life. And suddenly that plan is completely turned upside down. The rug is yanked out from under you, and you find yourself with a lot of other disoriented people living near the Kabar Canal, an irrigation canal near Babylon. Well, first, you have hopes that maybe this will be short. Maybe things will be worked out and we'll return quickly to Jerusalem and I can begin my training. But the weeks pass, the months pass. They become years. And 1 year becomes two, and two becomes three, and suddenly here you are and you're 30. The year you would have been a full-fledged priest, except that your apprenticeship has been snatched away from you. And now it's beginning to look like it will never happen. You spent your whole life preparing for this. You spent your whole life imagining this. And suddenly it's gone. That's who you are. You're Ezekiel. You're this would-be priest who's now not only unemployed, but unemployable in his chosen calling, in his determined calling. And so you can imagine There he is, perhaps discouraged, perhaps despondent. We don't really know. That's all speculation, but we can easily imagine that. You children probably haven't experienced it yet, but you adults certainly have. Something that you planned for, that you've waited for a long time, suddenly taken away from you. Expectations you have that don't work out. Plans that you make that suddenly fall apart. And the hurt. You can't really express it. There aren't really any words for it. But you know what Ezekiel felt. And so there he is, and he's out there one day, and he's walking along the Kabar Canal. And suddenly he looks up, and there's a storm coming at him from the north. Fire and lightning, and out of the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. Ezekiel, the would-be priest, now sees something that he has trouble describing. What is it that he saw? Well, I think we can be fairly confident that it was not an alien spaceship landing on the Babylonian plain in front of him. But I want us to consider, again, I'm not going to read it. It's long and it's complicated. And if you're anything like me, your mental imagination got lost somewhere around verse 7. Trying to picture what it is that Ezekiel described here. And part of our problem, I think, is we believe the Bible. We believe the Bible is to be taken literally. We believe the Word of God is to be taken. God is to be taken at His Word. And so we read this description and we try to make sense out of it. And perhaps some of you who are of an artistic bent might try to draw it or to paint it. But I think to read chapter 1 of Ezekiel and take that kind of approach to it is to mistake the point, to miss the point. What is it that Ezekiel saw? He tells us at the very end of the first chapter, last verse, he says, "Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord." Notice he doesn't tell us this was the glory of the Lord. He says, he doesn't even say this is the likeness of the glory of the Lord. He says, this is the likeness of the appearance of the glory of the Lord. In other words, this was the glory of the Lord, and this is as close as I can come to describing it. You've seen sunsets or sunrises. And sometimes they're, if you will, ordinary. Sometimes they're quite extraordinary. But what do you say when you're telling somebody about it? What do you say? You should have seen the sunset tonight. And there you stop. Because you're not quite sure how to describe it. The way the colors changed across the sky. The yellows going into oranges, going into reds, going into pinks. And hints of purple and gray in the clouds. And the way the rays of the sun reflect off some of the clouds. And you find yourself lost for an explanation. You really can't describe it. And so you just say, you shake your head and you say, you should have seen it. That's Ezekiel. The glory of the Lord has appeared to Ezekiel. And he has been completely overwhelmed. He falls on his face and hears a voice. And the voice of God calls to him and calls him to the task. We won't look at that tonight. Some of you have seen the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off. One of those entertaining 80s movies. Nothing that you have to worry about your kids seeing. Just three high school kids taking the day off, playing hooky, going to a ball game. And they go to an art museum. And at one scene, they're in the museum, and they're looking at a painting. And they're right up next to the painting. And all they see is dots. Dots on the canvas. Dots of different colors. Thousands, hundreds, spots of different colors on this canvas. It's an impressionistic technique called pointillism, in which the painting is not done with brush strokes, but with little dots of paint of different colors. And then in the movie, Cameron, Ferris's friend, begins to back away from the painting, and as he moves back and the painting then comes into focus, he sees what the painting is intended to be. It's not just a collection of dots of different colors. It's a portrait, an impressionistic portrait. But you see, because he's so fascinated at the beginning with the details of all these hundreds of thousands of little dots of color, he doesn't see the real picture. Ezekiel has painted for us, if you will, an impressionistic word picture. A pointillist word picture in which all of the details, the importance of the details, the importance of the little dots in that painting, those little dots of paint are important only insofar as they contribute to the larger whole. And it's only when you get the right distance away from the painting that you see the painting as it should be seen. And so I'd encourage you, as you reflect on Ezekiel chapter 1, don't get too concerned with the details of the descriptions. I would encourage you, though, to take note of how many times Ezekiel uses the phrase, "and it was like this." What does that phrase mean? It means it wasn't that. It was kind of like that. This is the closest I can come to describing it. You know, some of us are better at it than others, but most of us can describe somebody that we've met to another person and say, "Oh yeah, she was about 5'6", had shoulder length brown hair, etc., blue eyes, glasses, whatever." But when you're trying to describe something for which you have no categories, that's what Ezekiel is reduced to. He's at the limits of human language. This is as good as he can do to set before us the overwhelming nature of the appearance of the glory of the Lord. As the glory of the Lord descended before Ezekiel on that Babylonian plain and blew him, as it were, out of his sandals. He's trying to describe it. He's trying to get as close as he can, and he's not even getting close. He's taking us right to the edge, and there's a big gulf between that edge and the reality. You know, the problem with Eric von Daniken is not that he had too much imagination, but that he had too little. He couldn't see the glory of the Lord. Ezekiel saw the glory of the Lord, and he's giving his readers and he's giving his initial hearers, he's like me trying to describe a sunset to Lynn. I don't have language for it. I don't have the ability to pull that out of the air. That's what Ezekiel saw. The glory of the Lord landed right in front of him on that Babylonian plain. And he's gibbering. The description gives us an impression, but that's all it does. The would-be priest, flat on his face before the glory of the Lord. The third question is, where did he see it? Well, on the Babylonian plain. He's by the river Kabar. Opening verses tell us that. But you see, there's a problem here. And we don't see it. Why don't we see it? Because we're not Ezekiel. Because we didn't grow up in Jerusalem hoping to be priests. We didn't grow up in Jerusalem planning to be priests. Hearing that daily conversation from your father and his brothers as they talk about their business in the temple. Because you see, the glory of the Lord has appeared to Ezekiel in Babylon. It doesn't belong there. The glory of the Lord belongs in the temple in Jerusalem. It descended there. 1 Kings chapter 8. The dedication of Solomon's temple. The glory of the Lord descends upon the temple, and the priests can't even enter the temple to minister because the glory of the Lord has, if you will, blown them out. That's where the glory of the Lord belongs, in Jerusalem, at the temple. The glory of the Lord does not belong in Babylon. There's a major dislocation for Ezekiel here. Wait, I can't be seeing this. This isn't right. Something is fundamentally wrong here. We're in exile. We're hoping sometime soon to go back to Jerusalem. That's where we see the glory of the Lord. Hovering above the cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant, on top of the mercy seat in the temple. That's where the glory of the Lord belongs. The glory of the Lord doesn't belong here in Babylon. We're just a bunch of hostages who got caught in the middle of some political shenanigans. We're hoping to go home. We're not planning on staying long. But there it is. There it is. Ezekiel can't deny the reality of what he sees, the reality of what he hears, the awesome, overwhelming, fearsome power of the descent of the glory of the Lord on that Babylonian plain. And yet he can't get it out of his head that there's something fundamentally wrong here. Because the glory of the Lord doesn't belong in exile. But that's where it is. In the book of Jeremiah, chapter 24, Jeremiah was a somewhat older contemporary of Ezekiel. The Lord gives him a vision. And he says, Jeremiah, what do you see? And Jeremiah says, well, I see two baskets of figs. One basket, the figs are so bad that nobody would eat them. The other basket, they're good, they're ripe figs. The Lord says, you've seen well, Jeremiah. You're right, there's one basket of really bad figs, one basket of really good figs. And let me tell you something, Jeremiah, the Lord says, that basket of good figs, you're probably thinking they represent the people in Jerusalem. They don't. They represent the people in exile. God did the same, gave Ezekiel the same message in an entirely different way. God is announcing to Ezekiel, no, I'm not displaced. I'm right where I should be, in the middle of my people. Now, why the divine glory goes into exile, we will look at tomorrow evening. But that's the significance of the location. Ezekiel, the would-be priest, sees the glory of the Lord on a Babylonian plain. And the world is different. Because you see, growing up in that priestly household, Ezekiel had a certain sense of the way things ought to be. A certain sense of how reality is structured. And now, the glory of God has appeared to him on a Babylonian plain, and he has to rethink all of his categories. The world has been turned upside down. Everything has been changed, and Ezekiel has had a new vision of God. And so, as we read in chapter 3, he goes home and he sits there dumb for a week, mulling over what he's seen, reflecting on what it is that God has told him. And we'll explore that more tomorrow and then on Sunday. But what does it mean for us? John chapter 4. Passage you're familiar with. The Samaritan woman at the well. There's Jesus. Typical. Going where he has no business going. Talking to people he has no business talking to. He sends his disciples into town to get some food and sits there by the well, and this woman comes along. You're familiar with the story. John's probably preached on it a couple of times. Why is she out there in the middle of the day? Because she's a woman with a bad reputation. But he begins speaking to her, and that she doesn't have any categories for that. He says, you're a Jew. Why are you talking to me, a Samaritan, let alone a Samaritan woman? And he tells her to go call her husband. And she says, I don't have a husband. Jesus tells her that he knows. You know, sometimes people start asking questions and they get uncomfortable, and so you sort of try to redirect the conversation. That's what the woman does here. She says, sir, I see you're a prophet. Riddle me this then. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. But you say, that is, you Jews say, that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. The hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. You see, the Samaritan woman still had Ezekiel's confusion. She didn't want to know if there was a proper place where God was to be worshipped. She simply wanted to know which place that was. And Jesus scrambles your categories. He said at this point, it's a meaningless question. It doesn't matter anymore. The Apostle John really sets it before us in John chapter 1. He says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen His what? Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Came and dwelt among us. Paul represents it in another way in Philippians chapter 2. Jesus leaving heavenly glory and coming down and dwelling in the midst of His exiled brethren. God now is not limited, never has been limited in space and time, but for a period in the Old Testament, He limited His visible presence to a place on a mountain in Palestine. But Ezekiel walks by that irrigation canal, and God blows the whole boat out of the water, showing up where He has no business being in a way that completely overwhelms Ezekiel, prefiguring for us the completely unexpected appearance of His own Son in all of His veiled glory to that same people about 600 years later. Some of them believed. They followed Ezekiel's example. Many did not. We'll hear about others who didn't hear Ezekiel's message, didn't receive it. But you know, we have a tendency as well to think that somehow place is more important than it is. We're still thinking in Ezekiel's terms before the appearance of the glory of the Lord on that plain in Babylon. We're thinking that there's a right place for God to be. It's here in this building. Or it's down the street in that other building. Or perhaps any church will do, just as long as it's a church. There I can go and there I can really get in touch with God. Whereas the truth is, place doesn't matter anymore. Paul puts it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? The overwhelming glory of God, embodied in a weird vision there to Ezekiel. The glory of God veiled in the God-man, Jesus. We have beheld His glory, John says. Peter says, we touched, we handled, He was real. But the glory of God was in Him. And now in us as well. You know, we're not any better than those exiles, those hostages in Babylon. We don't deserve it any more than they did. But Ezekiel's vision tells us that it's true, that God has come to dwell in the midst of His people, and He won't leave. He won't abandon. He won't forsake. He won't let go. And I hope as we continue our travels through the book of Ezekiel and all of its wonderful strangeness, that the one thing will come out of it is with the assurance that that is true. That God dwells in the midst of His people. He will not abandon them. He will not forsake them. Even when we feel abandoned or forsaken, Emmanuel, God with us. Let's pray.